So we'll try and generate joyous effort in response to the different kinds of laziness that often afflict us. The difficulty is that what is laziness from a Buddhist viewpoint, we consider happiness and pleasure. So let's just do a little visualization and imagination that we have all of this happiness and pleasure, what we consider happiness and pleasure. So imagine that you don't have to go to work unless you want to. So you can sleep as late as you want to every morning. No alarm clock. Nobody's going to get on your case. You sleep late. So just really get into it. You can nap in the middle of the day after lunch. Stretch out for a nice nap. Go to bed early. And you can be busy in between doing all the things that you like to do. Okay, so your whole day, you don't have to go to work unless you want to. So your whole day you can spend on your hobbies and your social life. So you get together with friends every evening, drink, smoke, whatever you do with your friends. Okay, nothing to stop you, you can do that every day. You can do all of your hobbies, all the creative endeavors that you've always wanted to do. You can go to painting classes and dancing classes, aerobic classes. You can travel and go to all sorts of exotic places. You keep yourself very, very busy, okay, basically with social life and hobbies. And, you know, and then you can sleep late, nap, go to bed early, watch TV whenever you want. You have all the channels, all the latest music equipment. You know, or if your thing is getting hooked into the internet, you can spend hours every day on that. So just imagine that this is your life. Just imagine what that would be like. Really get into it. So you have years of this kind of life. You accumulate awards, you accumulate diplomas, you accumulate prestigious things. You're very popular and well-liked, lots of friends, lots of fun, do all the sporting things you want to, and out in nature as much as you want to. And then one day you die. And so imagine yourself on your deathbed after having lived your life like that. And what's going to be going on in your mind as you're dying? You're leaving from this body and separating, and you look back upon your life, how do you feel about your life? And what state is your mind in as it's departing from this body? What's that mind like as it's having to depart from all of its objects of attachment that were so well cultivated through hobbies and social life? And how do you feel about the value of your life? What do you have to show? And as we're dying from that life of rest and relaxation and leisure and fun, what do we have to look forward to? What's our future life going to be like? So in this way, by reflecting upon impermanence and death, by reflecting upon disadvantages of cyclic existence, see if the mind automatically has more energy and enthusiasm for Dharma practice. See if the mind automatically has some joy and some wish to meditate and go to teachings and to retreat, study and discuss. See if the mind has some more energy to actually transform itself. And then just stay in that state of increased energy and that feeling of enthusiasm and joy for the practice. Knowing what a life, having done Dharma practice, will give us, and what all the benefits it will bring and problems it will prevent. And then let's think a little bit about the laziness of discouragement when we feel that we're incapable, or that the path's too difficult, or the goal is out of our reach. That lack of energy we feel from being discouraged. And then for a few minutes recall the preciousness of this human life, the fact of being human, having our physical and mental health, being in a place where we have access to Dharma teachings and teachers, having some enthusiasm for interest in virtue. So for a few minutes just recall the attributes of a precious human life and let that uplift your mind. Remember how Shakyamuni Buddha began just like us, in the same state of confusion and bewilderment. But how Shakyamuni and so many other practitioners, Milarepa, Lama Tsongkhapa, so many, they engaged in the path, did the practice, and attained full enlightenment. So remember their examples and how they had to deal with obstacles just like we do. But they found a way to overcome the obstacles or pacify them. And so similarly we can. So let your mind get confident due to that. And remember also your Buddha nature, that aspect of the mind that enables us to become fully enlightened Buddhas, that quality of mind that is never separate from mind. So even bees and mosquitoes and all the other animals, they have Buddha potential, the Buddha nature. We do also. We can never be separated from it. So if we have that, we have a precious human life, we have the examples of other people who have done what we want to do, and let your mind feel buoyant and again joyful to be able to practice, a real sense of delight and uplifting aspiration for how meaningful our life can become. any reflections on that meditation? Did your mind change?
I
can't hear you.
The first meditation.
Uh-huh.
I'm the real good. Great. I'll take that way. Just waiting for the other shoe to drop.
I mean, there's definitely an underlying malaise. Well, how about everybody else accepts it? Talking just about having leisure time in which you can choose. I was talking about when we keep our life so chock-a-block full with projects that we actually have no time because we're so busy running to different things. You know, and that's interspersed with these long, you know, waking up late and napping and going to bed early and channel surfing. So we feel we have no time, but actually there's lots of time. Was that meditation a total failure? Should I go back to
it? Well, I also thought that there are people that I think that they live that way, and they, I don't feel like they die on that spot, you know?
Don't you?
No, I just feel like they felt, you know, and some people just feel like they did real good, and they, you know, they don't, I mean, Christians will feel like they won't go to that one, you know, they did okay and they collect with the kids, and I don't know, I haven't seen the guy, but I have to
I think it might be real useful sometimes for people to see more people die and to see more people go through the death procedure as the body deteriorates and the mind loses its ability. It might, it's quite helpful to our Dharma practice to really be involved in that and witness it. Yeah? Or to really know people who have had everything in life and what happens when they get old. What their old age is like. Very interesting if you know some of those people. Okay.
Did all sorts of good for society and it was wonderful, and after father had all kinds of things. Just really incredible to look at. And I really didn't want to think of my precious mother, so it was good to
tell. Yeah.
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 opportunity doesn't have come up. You haven't had a time to make the right time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You had something, Tom?
Yeah, it's funny because Marsha was talking about the small science system, but I was thinking, not specifically, but with that kind of the idea of having it all, but then starting to realize when you're dying, that you really missed the opportunity or the point in life, just the confusion that would seem to come up around that. And that maybe it, wasn't in terms of Alzheimer's confusion, but just, the general confusion of how to like spend my life. I'm sure I have a lot of pleasures to it. Kind of what I think I'm doing.
Yeah. Very much.
And then maybe I didn't do a whole lot of bad things in that meditation, that were sent a whole lot of really negative potential down, but so what did I send out to?
Right, and what did... Right, Or feeling of having given something to someone. Okay. Anyway, just think about that and, maybe play around with it and see if it creates a little bit more energy and joyous effort for practice. I don't know, maybe people need to be in a retreat situation to break through this kind of stuff. Maybe, kind of coming once a week, the mind isn't strong enough to see the disadvantages of cyclic existence because we're so involved in it. It might take a retreat situation for people to really, go in depth and spend some time and really work on this.
It's possible to do it in your life.
Well, I think we need both kinds of things, because the retreat situation really gives us a break and an ability to look at something, sometimes a bit more objectively. And also because sometimes there's this tendency to feel, oh, I'm using my daily life for practice. But,
I feel like actually for me it didn't happen until after. Because I feel like, I don't know, the psychology things have like an addictive relationship. when you're far away from this relationship, you're exaggerating it. Mm-hmm. So when you are in retreat, like sometimes in my mind will exaggerate the good about what I'm not having. Like I said, I crave going up to supermarket.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I got out of retreat, it's when I realized the peace and the happiness that I got from the wandering away from it, and I come back to regular life, then I realized that being with myself and having that peace and having that deep perception gave me something that I could not have gotten from staying out of retreat. So actually, it was more connected to a lot of people. And the more I read now, it's coming from everywhere. Probably it was always there, but I mean, it's here. It's like from the Aborigines and from a lot of people who have found more happiness by rejecting the super easy lifestyle.
Very much. Sometimes we don't realize how much we've changed in retreat until after we come out of retreat. Okay. So, I don't know if I'll meet you guys on any more meditations. What kind of laziness is that? Okay, so that was just to review the enthusiasm. Then we had the one of pliancy, and we covered that last week. And the question had come up about it being cultivated in stabilizing meditation or in analytic meditation. And actually, in the text, they usually refer to it as being cultivated specifically in stabilizing meditation when we're working to develop calm abiding. But to do calm abiding meditation, it's really helpful to have done a lot of analytic meditation so that we really understand the path and we understand what we're doing. Okay. Otherwise, just sitting and developing calm abiding, even non-Buddhists do that, and we don't even necessarily have a positive motivation to develop it. So the analytic meditation and the understandings that we get from that lead to a good motivation, indirectly help us to develop the concentration and thus the pliancy. And then after we have the concentration, we put that concentration together with the analytic mind. And that's called the union of calm abiding and special insight of shamatha and vipassana. And so there, you're able to have the pliancy and also do the analysis. Okay, now the next one is conscientiousness. So this is a distinct mental factor that cherishes the accumulation of virtue and guards the mind against that which gives rise to disturbing attitudes. It brings to fulfillment and maintains all that is good, keeps the mind from contamination, and is the route for attaining all the grounds and paths. So they say that a life without conscientiousness is a meaningless life. It's like being spiritually dead, because that part of us which cherishes what is virtuous, what is positive, is completely dormant, completely blah. Okay? So the conscientiousness, when you think, that part of you that really cherishes what is worthwhile, what is virtuous, that part of us that has that attitude that can think of enlightenment and get a little bit kind of uplifted about it and think how wonderful that would be, that part of us that could look at the deeds of the bodhisattva or somebody that we really admire and really respect that and cherish that accumulation of virtue so that we want to develop it ourselves. Okay? So this is a state of mind that is free of attachment and hatred and bewilderment, and it's also a mind that's full with the joyous effort. So the conscientiousness really cherishes what is positive, and it gives a lot of meaning to our life. Okay, it's interesting how this one comes after the meditation that we did. Okay, so that's why they say it's the root of all the grounds and paths, because when we have this kind of cherishing of virtue, then of course we're going to have the aspiration and the enthusiasm, we'll engage in the practice to actualize it. So the conscientiousness also prevents our mind from acting negatively. So in some ways it works like the sense of personal integrity and consideration for others do, except not for the specific reasons like those other two mental factors do. Okay, those other two mental factors are more focused on, you know, wanting to abandon what is negative for either, you know, due to our sense of personal integrity and respect for our own accumulation of virtue, or for, in terms of how it would affect others. Whereas this one is related to it, but this one more is an appreciation of what is virtuous. Okay, and it enables us to protect our vows. Okay, because without conscientiousness, then our vows, our practice, nothing has any meaning, nothing has any value, because we don't cherish any of it. And so our mind becomes very, very reckless. When this one of conscientiousness is weak, then our mind is really reckless. And we know that kind of reckless state of mind, don't we? Yeah, when we just go in a situation, we just kind of say, well, what the hell, you know, nobody else is watching. We just forget all of our values. We forget our own sense of our spiritual aspiration, of what's meaningful and worthwhile in ourself and in our life. And we just get completely, you know, kind of swept away by the excitement or, you know, of the situation. Okay, so especially when there's substances involved, you know, when there's dope and alcohol, our conscientiousness definitely goes. Yeah. And similarly, you know, sometimes when we have too much sense stimulation, you know, the music's really loud, there's a lot of visual stimulation, our senses are too stimulated, then also the sense of conscientiousness goes, because we're just like we're jaded sensually. Yeah. So the conscientiousness helps us to be really aware, and it diverts our mind from things that are negative by cherishing what is virtuous. And so, like in Shantideva's text, Paita Bodhisattva's Way of Life, there's a whole chapter on conscientiousness, you know, because it's such an important thing. And he talks a lot about, like, if you have, like, a wound on your arm, if you, you know, hurt your arm, and it's wounded. When you go in a crowd full of people, you know, when you go to the bus station or the train station or the airport or you go to a party, if you have a big wound on your hand, you're really careful. And, you know, you're quite aware, you're quite conscientious how you relate to everything in the environment, because you're really aware of how easy it is to get hurt and damaged if you're reckless. And so similarly, if we have this mental fact of conscientiousness regarding what is virtuous, we have that same sense of awareness towards everything in our environment, because we realize that in some ways our mind with its negative predispositions is like an open wound. And, you know, all it needs to do is knock against certain objects and those negative predispositions. It's like knocking, you know, your raw wound against something and there you are. So, you know, our mind is kind of like that open wound with those negative predispositions. So we have to guard it in the same way and not be reckless and not just kind of, you know, lose our awareness and blend in with the situation and forget about what we, you know, our value system and the meaning of our lives. Okay. But I think that example, you know, with an injured arm, to me that really hits the point, you know, kind of how the mind, how careful we are. It's a sense of real carefulness because we don't want to get hurt. Well, this is the mental factor, too, that enables us to be careful in situations. Okay. So this mental factor, the mind is in a positive state when we have this one. It's not some kind of, you know, oh, I'm really afraid I'm going to get attached. I'm really afraid I'm going to blow it. It's not this kind of nervousness and lack of self-confidence, but more this is a real positive state of appreciation for that virtuous part of ourselves. Okay? So, you know, as we're studying all these things, try and find this part of yourself. Okay? Because mindfulness is holding in your mind the, let's say, the 10 positive actions and the 10 negative actions. So mindfulness is just being aware of your value, you know, kind of what's negative and what's positive in such a way that other things that come in don't distract you and take you away from that. And so conscientiousness kind of comes together with that, in the sense that conscientiousness is the valuing of all of those things. If you have conscientiousness, then you're going to be mindful. If you don't have conscientiousness, then you have no reason to be mindful. You know, it's like if we don't cherish what is virtuous, okay, then why be mindful of, you know, the 10 positive actions? Why hold them in mind? And why have introspective alertness that's checking up and seeing what our body, speech, and mind is doing? Okay, so without conscientiousness, our mindfulness, our introspective alertness are also going to be very weak. Okay. So they talk about, keeping our precepts, or even if you don't have precepts, you know, if you think about living according to the 10 positive actions, abandoning the 10 negative ones, they often talk about 4 doors that will help us do that, and we're 4 points for things that will help us do that, and similarly 4 things that take us away from doing it. Okay, so the thing one of the things that helps us do that is knowing what's positive and what's negative. So knowing something about karma, or knowing what our precepts are, knowing, you know, having an awareness of what to cultivate and what to abandon. And so the thing that would that's the opposite of that. Is arising when we get involved in negative things, is a total lack of discrimination or knowledge of what is positive and what's negative. Okay. So we have this one a lot. Now this one isn't present every time we act negatively, but this is one of the possibilities, one of the doors through which negative action can you know, grow. And then the second thing, okay, what helps us to you know, keep our virtue is this mental fact of conscientiousness, and the one that takes us away from it is a lack of conscientiousness, a completely reckless mind, a lack of caring about what's worthwhile. Okay, and then the third factor is mindfulness and introspective alertness, okay, because that helps us to be aware of, you know, what's positive and negative, hold that in our mind so that we don't get distracted to different things. And that's the mindfulness, and the introspective alertness is the one that, you know, keeps checking, you know, what's going on, what am I saying, doing, and thinking, and feeling. And so the lack of that, which, you know, is the absence of mindfulness and introspective alertness, that's another door through which negative action comes about. And then the fourth one, okay, the thing that's going to protect us is not having our disturbing attitudes in excess. Yeah, in other words, our disturbing attitudes are somehow manageable. And the opposite thing, the door through which, you know, a lot of our negative actions and breaking the precepts comes, is because our disturbing attitudes are so strong. Okay, so we just get overwhelmed about this. So actually, these 4 points are quite interesting to think about, you know, when you sit and just do some reflection on your life. You know, like when you do before you do Vajrasattva meditation, you're thinking of different things that you want to purify, and then kind of go through these 4, and well, you know, here I did this thing. Well, what was going on in my mind? You know, okay, I just really told somebody off. Well, was it the first one that you know, I didn't know what was positive and negative? Was it that? Was that? No, it wasn't really that. I mean, I know I don't really tell people off. Was it a lack of conscientiousness? Was it a lack of mindfulness and awareness? Was it having, you know, my disturbing attitudes being too strong? Okay. So sometimes looking at it this way, it shows us the point to really work on in order not to fall into the same pitfall again. Okay. And so, you know, if you sit and use these 4 things and meditate on them, you really get like a good understanding of how to put our life together so that it hangs together in a way that is going to bring something good, you know, instead of just reenacting our disasters. Okay? So really take those 4, of which conscientiousness is one, and really make many, many examples in your life especially as you think of things to purify and see, you know, well, how was that that I got involved in it?
So the part about not having a disturbing attitude to an ex, but I guess you could still have a disturbing attitude, but to a certain extent that could be virtue.
Well, you're disturbing. Well, you know.
Well, that's what it sounds like. I mean, it is possible to have a disturbing attitude to a certain point and still keep your virtue, but if you take it excessively, if you don't try to control it at that point, that's going to be different.
Yeah. Right, but it's also, we have degrees of virtue and non-virtue. So it's like, you know, we might be going along and a little bit of attachment comes in the mind. So, I mean, that's creating some non-virtue, but we haven't kind of completely blown the whole thing. So with a little bit of attachment, then we can apply the antidote. We can meditate on death or something like that. Meditate on the disadvantages of attachment. And then overcome it so we don't keep carrying it out, so that we don't wind up with a whole complete beautiful 100%, you know, grade A negative karma. Yeah. So if it starts out small, then we can oppose it. Whereas if the attachment just comes on like womp, you know, then it's like the mind's totally gone. You know, it's so difficult to oppose. So difficult. Okay. So that's what it means, like not having it in excess. You know, you have it a little bit, so it's, you know, it's not good to have that, but at least, you know, it's manageable. You can do something about it. Because I think we've all experienced what it's like when our attachment just takes over and runs the boat, when our anger takes over, when our jealousy takes over. Right? And so when we have the disturbing attitudes in excess like that, I mean, that's one of the chief things that makes us feel bad about ourselves. Okay, so then we see why it's important to have conscientiousness, why it's important to have mindfulness and alertness. Okay, so they have different ways of categorizing conscientiousness. There's a few different kinds. I'll go through one of the ways of categorizing it, which is into five. Okay. Now remember, there can be some overlapping amongst these. There is with these five. So here, this one way of dividing it is, the first one is conscientiousness with respect to the former. So former meaning past actions, past negative actions. And so this is, we're conscientious with respect to previous negative actions. So that leads us to have regret. So this first one, you know, is joined with regret, which is the first of the four opponent powers. Remember when we're doing purification practice, regret is the first of the four opponents. So this one type of conscientiousness with respect to things in the past helps us to generate this regret, and that enables us to actually remedy the past mistakes we've made. The second kind of conscientiousness is conscientiousness with respect to the subsequent, or respect to the what comes later. And so this is an earnest intention to remedy or to avoid future mistakes. So, you know, when we're doing purification, another one of the four opponent powers is the determination not to repeat the action. So that's joined with this. Okay? So we're looking towards future things, and we're being conscientious towards future things, and having a strong determination to avoid them. Then the third one is called conscientiousness with respect to the middle. Okay, so we had the former and the subsequent, now we have the middle. And so this is remedying faults without forgetfulness in the present. Okay, so this is being constantly mindful and having introspective alertness, so that things that come up in the present moment we're able to oppose. So this is kind of avoiding the negative things. With an earnest intention. No, sorry. It's remedying faults without forgetfulness in the present. Okay? And then the fourth one is conscientiousness prior to activity. And so this is kind of concentrating the mind and really generating the intention not to become involved in negative things. Okay, just concentrating the mind and thinking how wonderful it would be if I could actually keep it together in this situation. Yeah? So I know what helped me, especially what I did a lot at the beginning of the practice, and I still do it now, but at the beginning of the day when I think of, or even before a trip, if I'm going somewhere and I know I'm going to encounter certain kinds of things, I think of the kind of people I might meet or the kind of situations I might encounter. And especially, you know, when you're going into situations and we know that it's so easy for our buttons to get pushed when we're in certain situations or with certain people. Okay? So you kind of do a meditation, become aware of the situations you might find yourself in, and then develop this fourth kind of conscientiousness, thinking, wouldn't it be wonderful if instead of just, you know, having my typical knee-jerk responses, I actually, you know, was able to keep it together and didn't let myself get offended when this person says the thing that usually pushes my buttons, okay? Or didn't let myself feel inferior when this person does their thing, okay? So this is a real nice way to meditate, to protect our mind against future things and make it stable and it's also quite helpful, I found it quite helpful, for breaking kind of these neurotic patterns that we get into, you know, especially with certain people, how, you know, the moment we're around certain people, we just act in a certain way, and there we go again, and there they go again, yeah? Yeah, and so, you know, just kind of doing this meditation about, you know, things you could encounter and generating a strong intention and conscientiousness with respect. Resolution workshop, he was saying when you're in a habitual kind of conflict, you know, reenacting the same thing you always do, he said, do the thing you least want to do. Yeah? He said, act completely different from how you usually react, because if you do that, then that whole cycle of how we two people feed off each other, or a whole system feeds, everybody feeds off each other, that's broken. Okay? So when we have that kind of conscientiousness, then it enables us to act differently in the situation. So it actually, you know, can change the external conflict as well. Okay. And then the fifth kind of conscientiousness is the conscientiousness of concordant behavior. So this is, in the situation, acting as you generated the intention to act in the fourth kind of conscientiousness. Okay? Okay? So, it's concordant behavior. So as you generated the intention with the fourth kind of conscientiousness, the conscientiousness prior to the activity, as you generated that intention, then you act according to that. So it becomes concordant behavior. So you act in such a way that the faults don't arise. Okay? And so in that way, we're quick to stop the negative mind or stop the negative actions. Okay? So, you know, before you go to the family dinner, you cultivate the fourth kind of conscientiousness. And then when you're at the dinner, then you develop the fifth one. And you really try and act upon how you generate the motivation. Okay? Okay. Yeah, this is all analytical meditation, but then as you're doing it, then when you come to a conclusion and you have some kind of feeling about it, then hold your mind single-pointedly just on that feeling, on that conclusion. Okay? So when you're doing this and you come to a conclusion, let's say, of how you want to act or how you don't want to act, then don't just, you know, keep on going. You know, just really hold your mind with concentration on that conclusion. Let that sink into your mind. Okay, let that really become part of you. Stop the analysis at that point. Okay. So one of my teachers was saying that cherishing what is positive, cherishing what is virtuous, this is the kind of attitude we should have, the same way we cherish, you know, very precious jewels. Or the same way we cherish our new credit card or our new car, you know, whatever the material thing is that we cherish so much. This cherishing of virtue should be similar.
how long can you meditate on the same conclusion? I won't argue. If you get to that conclusion, and you went a single point to meditate.
Yeah.
I mean, how long? Just, you get to the conclusion. What is the conclusion?
Then just let your mind be peaceful. It's like you've reached that conclusion, and your mind is completely free of any kind of willingness to argue. It's like you don't have any willingness to argue. You don't have any interest to argue. Your mind's just really peaceful, and just stay in that peaceful state. You know, just really feel what it feels like not to have any wish to argue with someone. It feels kind of nice. Yeah? So just kind of let your mind stay in that state.
And then what you do is like you're in a situation where arguments are coming, you just recollect that experience of what you tell.
Right. Right.
It's just a single pointiness. I don't know, I guess I have a thing about single
pointiness. Oh, okay.
A conception of an idea, like, or argue, because single point for me has something to do with non-duality, and the non-duality of non-arguing is so confusing that
right.
I...
No, we can be single-pointed when we're not doing meditation on emptiness, when we're not talking about non-duality, but just when we have... It's like if you do the meditation on loving-kindness and you have a loving and affectionate feeling, then you just keep your mind there. You hold that feeling. Do you want to come in? Oh, okay. Okay. So actually we have two more of the 11 virtuous mental factors. We have non-harmfulness and then equanimity. Okay. And so there are actually more than 11 virtuous mental factors, but these 11 are pointed out because they're so important in our practice. So don't just think that there's 11, you know. Okay, you know, and how come there's only 11 virtuous ones and then there's 6 root disturbing, 84,000 of the other ones. No, it's actually there's 84,000 of the virtuous ones too, but they kind of picked out these 11 big groups to really emphasize and help us in our practice.